not alone in uniform for fear of these mobs, and that even when in greater numbers, harassment from the public soon drove them back to their quarters, save when compelled by duty to persist. A patrol of 5 soldiers was so beset one evening, pursued not only by insults of the grossest nature, but by hurled stones, clods of earth, and dung, and other such rubbish. Such was the press of the mob around them that the men feared for their safety, and thus presented their weapons in hopes of discouraging the raucous attentions rained upon them. So far from accomplishing this aim, the action provoked still greater outrage from the crowd, and at some point a gun was fired. No one can say for sure whether the shot was discharged from the crowd or from one of the soldiers' weapons, let alone whether it were by accident or in deliberation. But the effect of it, well, you will have sufficient knowledge of such matters to imagine the confusion of subsequent events. In the end, 5 of the mob were killed, and while the soldiers were buffeted and badly handled, they escaped alive, only to be made scapegoats by the malicious rantings of the mob's leaders in the press, these so styled as to make it seem a wanton and unprovoked slaughter of innocents, rather than a matter of self-defence against a mob inflamed by drink and sloganeering. I confess that my sympathies must lie altogether with the soldiers. I am sure so much is obvious to you. They were brought to trial, where the judge discovered 3 to be innocent, but no doubt felt it would be dangerous to his own situation to free them all. Higgins, with 1 other, was convicted of manslaughter, but pled clergy and was released after his branding. The army, of course, discharged him, and without means of making a living, and subject to the opprobrium of the populace, he found himself in sad case. He tells me that he was beaten in a tavern soon after his release, injuries inflicted therein depriving him of the sight in 1 eye, and, in fact, his very life was threatened on more than 1 occasion. So, seeking safety, he took passage on a sloop captained by my friend Captain Gill, working as a sailor, though I have seen him sail, and I assure you he is not one. This state of affairs became soon evident to Captain Gill, who terminated his employment upon arrival at their first port. I was in the town on business, and encountered Captain Gill, who told me of Higgins' desperate situation. I contrived to find the man, feeling some pity for a soldier who appeared to me to have performed his duty honourably, and thinking it hard that he should suffer by it. Discovering him to be intelligent and of a generally agreeable character, I engaged him in service, wherein he has proved most faithful. I send him with the wine, in the hopes that your wife might be so kind as to examine him. The local physician, one Dr. Potts, has seen him, and declares the injury to his eye irretrievable, as indeed it may be. Having some personal experience of your wife's skill, however, I wonder whether she might suggest treatment for his other ills. Dr. Potts was unable to be of much help. Tell her, please, that I am her humble servant, and remain in perpetual gratitude for her kindness and ability. My warmest regards to your daughter, for whom I have sent a small present, to arrive with the wine. I trust her husband will not take offence at my familiarity, by consideration of my long acquaintance with your family, and will allow her to accept it. As always, I remain your obedient servant, John Gray. Chapter 9. The Threshold of War. April, 1773. Robert Higgins was a slight young man, so thin as to seem that his bones were barely held together by his clothes, and so pale that it was easy to imagine you could, in fact, see through him. He was, however, graced with large, candid blue eyes, a mass of wavy, light brown hair, and a shy manner that caused Mrs. Bugg to take him at once under her wing and declare a firm intent to feed him up before he should depart back to Virginia. I quite liked Mr. Higgins myself. He was a sweet-natured boy, with the soft accent of his native Dorset. I did rather wonder, though, whether Lord John Grey's generosity toward him was as unselfish as it seemed. I had come reluctantly to like John Grey, too, after our shared experience of the measles a few years earlier, and his friendship to Brianna while Roger was held captive by the Iroquois. Still, I remained acutely aware of the fact that Lord John did like men, specifically Jamie, but certainly other men as well. Beecham, I said to myself, laying out trillium roots to dry, you have a very suspicious mind.
Aye, you have, said a voice behind me, sounding amused. Whom do you suspect of doing what?
I jerked in startlement and sent trilliums flying in all directions. Oh, it's you, I said crossly. Why must you sneak up on me like that?
Practice, Jamie said, kissing me on the forehead. I shouldn't have liked to lose my touch at stalking game.
Why'd you talk to yourself? It assures me of a good listener, I said tartly. And he laughed, bending to help me pick up the roots from the floor.
Who are you suspecting, Sassnach?
I hesitated, but was unable to come up with anything but the truth. I was wondering whether John Grey's buggering our Mr. Higgins, I said baldly, or intends to. He blinked slightly, but didn't look shocked, which in itself suggested to me that he'd considered the same possibility.
What makes you think so?
He's a very pretty young man, for the one thing, I said, taking a handful of the roots from him and beginning to spread them out on a sheet of gauze. And he's got the worst case of piles I've ever seen in a man of his age, for another.
He let you look at them?
Jamie had flushed up himself at the mention of buggery. He disliked me being indelicate. But he'd asked, after all. Well, it took no little persuasion, I said. He told me about them readily enough, but he wasn't keen to have me examine them.
I wouldn't have cared for that prospect either, Jamie assured me, and I'm wed to you. Why on earth would you want to look at such a thing, beyond morbid curiosity?
He cast a wary glance at my big black casebook, open on the table.
You're no drawing pictures of poor Bobby Higgins' backside in there, are you?
No need. I can't imagine a physician in any time who doesn't know what piles look like. The ancient Israelites and Egyptians had them, after all.
They did?
It's in the Bible. Ask Mr. Christie, I advised. He gave me a sidelong look.
You've been discussing the Bible with Tom Christie? You're a braver man than I am, Sassnach.
Christie was a most devout Presbyterian, and never happier than when hitting someone over the head with a fistful of sacred scripture. Not me. Jermaine asked me last week what emerods are.
What are they?
Piles. Then said they, what shall be the trespass offering which we shall return to him? They answered, 5 golden emerods and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, I quoted. Oh, something of the sort. That's as close as I can come from memory. Mr. Christie made Jermaine write out a verse from the Bible as punishment, and having an inquiring sort of mind, Jermaine wondered what it was he was writing.
And he wouldn't ask Mr. Christie, of course.
Jamie frowned, rubbing a finger down the bridge of his nose.
Do I want to know what it was Jermaine did?
Almost certainly not. Tom Christie earned the quit rent on his land by serving as the local schoolmaster, and seemed capable of keeping discipline on his own terms. My opinion was that having Jermaine Fraser as a pupil was probably worth the entire amount, in terms of labour.
Gold emeralds, Jamie murmured. Well, there's a thought.
He had assumed the faintly dreamy air he often had just before coming up with some hair-raising notion involving the possibility of maiming, death, or life imprisonment. I found this expression mildly alarming, but whatever the train of thought triggered by golden hemorrhoids, he abandoned it for the moment, shaking his head.
Well, so, we were speaking of Bobby's backside.
Oh, yes. As for why I wanted to look at Mr. Higgins's emeralds, I said, returning to the previous point of conversation, I wanted to see whether the best treatment was amelioration or removal. Jamie's eyebrows went up at that.
Remove them? How? With your wee knife?
He glanced at the case where I kept my surgical tools and hunched his shoulders in aversion. I could, yes, though I imagine it would be rather painful without anaesthesia. There was a much simpler method just coming into widespread use, though, when I left. Just for a moment, I felt a deep twinge of longing for my hospital. I could all but smell the disinfectant, hear the murmur and bustle of nurses and orderlies, touch the glossy covers of the research journals bulging with ideas and information. Then it was gone, and I was estimating the desirability of leeches versus string with reference to Mr. Higgins achieving ideal anal health. Dr. Rawlins advises the use of leeches, I explained. 20 or 30, he says, for a serious case. Jamie nodded, showing no particular revulsion at the idea. Of course, he'd been leeched a few times himself, and assured me that it didn't hurt.
Aye, you haven't got that many on hand, do you? Shall I collect the wee lads and set them to gathering?
Jemmy and Germaine would like nothing better than an excuse to go bogging through the creeks with their grandfather, coming back festooned with leeches and mud to the eyebrows. But I shook my head. No. Or I mean, yes, I corrected. At your convenience, but I don't need them immediately. Using leeches would relieve the situation temporarily, but Bobby's hemorrhoids are badly thrombosed. Have clots of dried blood in them, I amended. And I think he really would be better off if I remove them entirely. I believe I can ligate them. Tie a thread very tightly round the base of each hemorrhoid, I mean. That starves them of blood, and eventually they just dry up and fall off. Very neat.
Very neat, Jamie murmured in echo.
He looked mildly apprehensive.
Have you done it before?
Yes, once or twice.
Ah.
He pursed his lips, apparently envisioning the process.
How, can he shit, do you think, while this is going on? It must take a bit of time, surely.
I frowned, tapping a finger on the countertop. His chief difficulty is that he doesn't shit, I said. Not often enough, I mean, and not with a proper consistency. Horrible diet, I said, pointing an accusatory finger at him. He told me, bread, meat, and ale. No vegetables, no fruit. Constipation is absolutely rife in the British Army, I don't doubt. I shouldn't be surprised if every man jack of them has piles hanging out of his arse like grape clusters. Jamie nodded, one eyebrow raised.
There are a great many things I admire about you, Sassenach. Especially the delicate manner of your conversation.
He coughed, glancing downward.
But if you say it's costiveness that causes piles...
It is.
Aye. Well, it's only... what you were saying about John Gray. I mean, you don't think the state of Bobby's ass is to do with...
Oh. Well, no. Not directly. I paused. It was more that Lord John said in his letter that he wanted me to... How did he put it?
I might suggest treatment for his other ills.
I mean, he might possibly know about Bobby's difficulty without, personal inspection, shall we say. But as I say, piles are so commonplace an affliction. Why ought he be concerned to the point of asking me to do something about them? Unless he thought that they might hamper his own eventual, progress. Jamie's face had resumed its normal hue during the discussion of leeches and constipation, but at this point went red again.
His...
I mean, I said, folding my arms beneath my bosom, I'm just a trifle put off by the notion that he sent Mr. Higgins down for repair, you might say. I'd been suffering from a niggling feeling of unease regarding the matter of Bobby Higgins's backside, but hadn't put this notion into words before. Now that I had, I realised precisely what was bothering me. The thought that I meant to be fixing up poor little Bobby and then sending him home to be... I pressed my lips together again and turned abruptly back to my roots, needlessly turning them. "I don't like the thought," I said to the cupboard door. "I'll do what I can for Mr. Higgins, mind. Bobby Higgins hasn't many prospects. No doubt he'll do whatever his lordship required. But perhaps I'm wronging him. Lord John, I mean."
"Perhaps you are."
I turned round to find Jamie sitting on my stool, fiddling with a jar of goose grease that seemed to have his full attention. "Well," I said uncertainly, "you know him better than I do. If you think he isn't..." My words trailed off. Outside there was a sudden soft thump as a falling spruce cone struck the wooden stoop.
"I ken more about John Grey than I wish I did," Jamie said finally,
and glanced at me, a rueful smile in the corner of his mouth.
"And he kens a great deal more about me than I like to think on. But..."
He leaned forward, setting down the jar, then put his hands on his knees and looked at me.
"I ken the one thing beyond doubt. He's an honourable man. He wouldna take advantage of Higgins, nor any other man, under his protection."
He sounded very definite about it, and I felt reassured. I did like John Grey. And still, the appearance of his letters, regular as clockwork, always gave me a faint sense of unease, like the hearing of distant thunder. There was nothing about the letters themselves to evoke such a response. They were like the man himself, erudite, humorous, and sincere. And he had reason to write, of course. More than one. "He does still love you, you know," I said quietly. He nodded, but didn't look at me, his gaze still fixed somewhere beyond the trees that edged the dooryard. "Would you rather he didn't?" He paused, then nodded again. This time, though, he did turn to look at me.
"I would, aye. For myself. For him, certainly. But for William?"
He shook his head, uncertain.
"Oh, he may have taken William on for your sake," I said, leaning back against the counter.
"But I've seen the two of them, remember? I've no doubt he loves Willie for his own sake now."
"No, I dinna doubt that either."
He got up, restless, and beat imaginary dust from the pleats of his kilt. His face was closed, looking inward at something he didn't wish to share with me. "Do you..." I began, but stopped when he glanced up at me.
"No,
it doesn't matter."
"What?"
He tilted his head to one side, eyes narrowing. "Nothing." He didn't move, merely intensified the stare.
"I can see from your face that it's not Sassenach. What?"
I breathed deeply through my nose, fists wrapped in my apron. "It's only, and I'm sure it isn't true, it's only a passing thought." He made a low Scottish noise indicating that I'd better stop blethering and cough it up. Having enough experience to realise that he wouldn't leave the matter till I did, I coughed. "Did you ever wonder whether Lord John might have taken him because, well, William does look terribly like you, and evidently did from an early age. Since Lord John finds you physically attractive..." The words died, and I could have cut my throat for speaking them, seeing the look on his face. He closed his eyes for a moment to stop me looking in. His fists were curled up so tightly that the veins stood out from knuckle to forearm. Very slowly he relaxed his hands. He opened his eyes.
"No,"
he said, complete conviction in his voice. He gave me a straight, hard look.
And it's no that I canna bear the thought of it either. I know.
Of course, I said, hastily, eager to leave the subject.
I know, he repeated more sharply. His two stiff fingers tapped once against his leg, and then stilled. I thought of it, too, when he first told me he meant to wed Isabel Dunsany.
He turned away, staring out through the window.
Adso was in the dooryard, stalking something in the grass. I offered him my body, Jamie said abruptly, not looking round. The words were steady enough, but I could see from the knotted shoulders how much it cost him to speak them. In thanks, I said. But it was...
He made an odd convulsive movement, as though trying to free himself from some constraint.
I meant to see Ken, what sort of man he might be, for sure. This man who would take my son for his own.
His voice shook very slightly when he said, take my son. And I moved to him by instinct, wanting somehow to patch the open wound beneath those words. He was stiff when I touched him, not wanting to be embraced. But he took my hand and squeezed it. Could you really tell, do you think?
I wasn't shocked. John Gray had told me of that offer years before in Jamaica. I didn't think he had realized the true nature of it, though.
Jamie's hand tightened on mine, and his thumb traced the outline of mine, rubbing lightly over the nail. He looked down at me, and I felt his eyes search my face. Not in question, but in the way one does when seeing anew some object grown familiar. Seeing with the eyes what has been seen for a long time, only with the heart. His free hand rose and traced the line of my brows, two fingers resting for an instant on the bone of my cheek, then moved up, back, cool in the warmth of my hair.
You canna be so close to another, he said finally, to be within each other, to smell their sweat and rub the hairs of your body with theirs, and see nothing of their soul. Or if you can do that.
He hesitated, and I wondered whether he thought of Black Jack Randall, or of Lyra, the woman he had married, thinking me dead.
Well, that is a dreadful thing in itself, he finished softly,
and his hand dropped away.
There was silence between us. A sudden rustle came from the grass outside as Adso lunged and disappeared, and a mockingbird began to shriek alarm from the big red spruce.
In the kitchen, something was dropped with a clang, and then the rhythmic swoosh of sweeping began. All the homely sounds of this life we had made. Had I ever done that? Lain with a man and seen nothing of his soul? Indeed I had, and he was right. A breath of coldness touched me, and the hairs rose silent on my skin. He heaved a sigh that seemed to come from his feet, and rubbed a hand over his bound hair.
But he wouldn't do it, John. He looked up then, and gave me a crooked smile. He loved me, he said, and if I couldn't give him that in return, and he can't, I couldn't. Then he'd not take counterfeit for true coin.
He shook himself hard, like a dog coming out of the water.
No, a man who would say such a thing is not one who'd bugger a child for the sake of his father's bonny blue eyes. I'll tell you that for certain, Sassenach.
No, I said. Tell me... I hesitated, and he looked at me, one eyebrow up. If he had, taken you up on that offer, and you'd found him, I fumbled for some reasonable wording, less, decent than you might hope.
I should have broken his neck there by the lake, he said. It wouldn't have mattered if they'd hanged me. I'd not have let him have the boy. But he didn't, and I did, he added with a half shrug. And if wee Bobby goes to his lordship's bed, I think it will be of his own free will.
No man is really at his best with someone else's hand up his arse. I had noticed this before, and Robert Higgins was no exception to the general rule. Now, this won't hurt much at all, I said, as soothingly as possible. All you need to do is to keep quite still.
Oh, I shall do that, ma'am. Indeed I will, he assured me fervently.
I had him on the surgery table, wearing only his shirt, and situated four square on hands and knees, which brought the area of operation conveniently to eye level. The forceps and ligatures I should need were placed on the small table to my right, with a bowl of fresh leeches alongside, in case of need. He emitted a small shriek when I applied a wet cloth soaked in turpentine to the area, in order to cleanse it thoroughly, but was as good as his word, and didn't move. Now, we're going to obtain a very good effect here, I assured him, taking up a pair of long-nosed forceps. But if the relief is to be permanent, there will have to be a drastic change in your diet. Do you understand me? He gasped deeply as I grasped one of the hemorrhoids and pulled it toward me. There were three. A classic presentation at 9, 2, and 5 o'clock. Bulbous as raspberries, and quite the same colour.
Ah. Yes, ma'am.
Oatmeal, I said firmly, transferring the forceps to my other hand without lessening the grip, and taking up a needle threaded with silk thread in my right. Porridge every morning without fail. Have you noticed a change for the better in your bowel habits since Mrs. Bug has been feeding you porridge for breakfast? I passed the thread loosely round the base of the hemorrhoid, then delicately pushed the needle up beneath the loop, making a small noose of it, and pulled tight.
Ah! Tell ye truth, ma'am, it's like shittin' bricks. Bricks covered with hedgehog skin. Makes no matter what I eat.
Well, it will, I assured him, securing the ligature with a knot. I released the hemorrhoid, and he breathed deeply. Now, grapes. You like grapes, don't you?
No, sets me teeth on edge to bite 'em.
Really? His teeth didn't look badly decayed. I should have a closer look at his mouth. He might be suffering from marginal scurvy. Well, we'll have Mrs. Bug make a nice raisin pie for you. You can eat that with no difficulty. Does Lord John have a capable cook? I took aim with my forceps and got hold of the next one. Now, accustomed to the sensation, he only grunted a bit.
Yes'm. Be an Indian, he is. Named Manaki.
Hmm. Round, up, tighten, tie off. I'll write out a receipt for the raisin pie for you to carry back to him. Does he cook yams? Or beans?
Beans are quite good for the purpose. I believe he does, ma'am, but his lordship...
I had the windows open for ventilation. Bobby was no filthier than the average, but he was certainly no cleaner. And at this point, I heard sounds from the trailhead, voices and the jingle of harness. Bobby heard them too, and glanced wildly at the window, hindquarters tensing as though to spring off the table like a grasshopper. I grasped him by one leg, and then thought better of it. There was no way of covering the window, bar closing the shutters, and I needed the light. "Go ahead and stand up," I told him, letting go and reaching for a towel. "I'll go and see who it is." He followed this direction with alacrity, scrambling down and reaching hastily for his breeches. I stepped out onto the porch in time to greet the two men who led their mules up over the last arduous slope and into the yard. Richard Brown and his brother Lionel, from the eponymously named Brownsville. I was surprised to see them. It was a good 3-day ride to Brownsville from the ridge, and there was little commerce between the two settlements. It was at least that far to Salem, in the opposite direction. But the inhabitants of the ridge went there much more frequently. The Moravians were both industrious and great traders, taking honey, oil, salt fish and hides in trade for cheese, pottery, chickens and other small livestock. So far as I knew, the denizens of Brownsville dealt only in cheap trade goods for the Cherokee and in the production of a very inferior type of beer. Not worth the ride.
Good day, mistress.
Richard, The smaller and elder of the brothers touched the brim of his hat, but didn't take it off.
Is your husband to home?
He's out by the hay barn, scraping hides. I wiped my hands carefully on the towel I was carrying. Do come round to the kitchen. I'll bring up some cider.
Don't trouble.
Without further ado, he turned and set off purposefully round the house. Lionel Brown, a bit taller than his brother, though with the same spare, almost gangly build, and the same tobacco-coloured hair, nodded briefly to me as he followed. They had left their mules, reins hanging, evidently for me to tend. The animals were beginning to amble slowly across the yard, pausing to crop the long grass that edged the path. "Hm," I said, glaring after the brothers Brown.
"Who are they?" said a low voice behind me.
Bobby Higgins had come out and was peering off the corner of the porch with his good eye. Bobby tended to be wary of strangers, and no wonder, given his experiences in Boston.
"Neighbours, such as they are."
I lunged off the porch and caught one of the mules by the bridle as he reached for the peach sapling I had planted near the porch. Disliking this interference in his affairs, he brayed ear-splittingly in my face and attempted to bite me.
"Here, Mum, let me."
Bobby, already holding the other mule's reins, leaned past to take the halter from me.
"Arkady," he said to the obstreperous mule, "hush the noise, else I take a stick to thee, then."
Bobby had been a foot soldier rather than cavalry, it was clear to see. The words were bold enough, but ill-matched with his tentative manner. He gave a perfunctory yank on the mule's reins. The mule promptly laid back its ears and bit him in the arm. He screamed and let go both sets of reins. Clarence, my own mule, hearing the racket, set up a loud bray of greeting from his pen, and the two strange mules promptly trotted off in that direction, stirrup leathers bouncing. Bobby wasn't badly hurt, though the mule's teeth had broken the skin. Spots of blood seeped through the sleeve of his shirt. As I was turning back the cloth to have a look at it, I heard footsteps on the porch, and looked up to see Lizzie, a large wooden spoon in hand, looking alarmed.
"Bobby, what's happened?"
He straightened at once, seeing her, assuming nonchalance, and brushed a lock of curly brown hair off his brow.
"Ah, oh, naught, miss. Bit of trouble with those sons of Belial-like. No fear, it's fine."
Whereupon his eyes rolled up in his head and he fell over in a dead faint.
"Oh!"
Lizzie flew down the steps and knelt beside him, urgently patting his cheek.
"Is he all right, Mrs. Fraser?"
"God knows," I said frankly.
"I think so, though."
Bobby appeared to be breathing normally, and I found a reasonable pulse in his wrist.
"Shall we carry him inside, or should I fetch a burnt feather, do you think? Or the spirits of ammonia from the surgery, or some brandy?"
Lizzie hovered like an anxious bumblebee, ready to fly off in any of several different directions.
"No, I think he's coming round."
Most faints last only a few seconds, and I could see his chest lift as his breathing deepened.
"Bit of brandy wouldn't come amiss," he murmured,
eyelids beginning to flutter. I nodded to Lizzie, who vanished back into the house, leaving her spoon behind on the grass.
"Feeling a bit peaky, are you?" I inquired sympathetically.
The injury to his arm was no more than a scratch, and I certainly hadn't done anything of a shocking nature to him. Well, not physically shocking. What was the trouble here?
"I dunno, ma'am."
He was trying to sit up, and while he was white as a sheet, seemed otherwise all right, so I let him.
"It's only every now and again I gets these spots, like, whirring round me head like a swarm of bees, and then it all goes black."
"Now and again? It's happened before?" I asked sharply.
"Yes'm."
His head wobbled like a sunflower in the breeze, and I put a hand under his armpit lest he fall over again.
"His lordship was in hopes you might know summat would stop it."
"His lord... Oh, he knew about the fainting?"
"Well, of course he would, if Bobby were in the habit of falling over in front of him."
He nodded and took a deep, gasping breath.
"Dr. Potts bled me regular, twice a week, but it didn't seem to help."
"I dare say not."
I hope he was of somewhat more help with your piles,
I remarked dryly.
A faint tinge of pink,
he had scarcely enough blood to provide a decent blush, poor boy, rose in his cheeks, and he glanced away, fixing his gaze on the spoon.
I didn't mention that to anybody.
You didn't? I was surprised at that. But,
see, 'twas only the riding from Virginia.
The pink tinge grew.
I'd not have let on, save I was in such agony after a week on yon bloody horse. Save in your presence, ma'am. I'd no chance of hiding it.
So Lord John didn't know about that, either. He shook his head vigorously, making the dishevelled brown curls flop back over his forehead. I felt rather annoyed with myself for having evidently misjudged John Gray's motives, and with John Gray for making me feel a fool.
Well, are you feeling a bit better now?
Lizzie wasn't appearing with the brandy, and I wondered momentarily where she was.
Bobby was still very pale, but nodded gamely and struggled to his feet, where he stood swaying and blinking, trying to keep his balance. The M, branded on his cheek, stood out, an angry red against the pallid skin. Distracted by Bobby's feint, I had ignored the sounds coming from the other side of the house. Now, though, I became aware of voices and approaching footsteps. Jamie and the two Browns came into sight round the corner of the house, then stopped, seeing us. Jamie had been frowning slightly. The frown grew deeper. The Browns, by contrast, seemed oddly elated, although in a grim sort of way.
"So it's true, then."
Richard Brown stared hard at Bobby Higgins, then turned to Jamie. "You've a murderer on your premises."
"Have I?"
Jamie was coldly polite. "I'd no idea." He bowed to Bobby Higgins with his best French court manner, then straightened, gesturing to the Browns.
"Mr. Higgins, may I present Mr. Richard Brown and Mr. Lionel Brown? Gentlemen, my guest, Mr. Higgins."
The words, "my guest," were spoken with a particular emphasis that made Richard Brown's thin mouth compress to near invisibility.
"Have a care, Fraser," he said, staring hard at Bobby as though daring him to evaporate. "Keeping the wrong company can be dangerous these days."
"I choose my company as I will, sir."
Jamie spoke softly, biting off each word between his teeth.
"And I do not choose yours. Joseph!"
Lizzie's father, Joseph Weems, appeared round the corner, leading the two renegade mules, who now seemed docile as kittens, though either of them dwarfed Mr. Weems. Bobby Higgins, flabbergasted by the proceedings, looked wildly at me for explanation. I shrugged slightly and kept silence as the two Browns mounted and rode out of the clearing, backs stiff with anger. Jamie waited till they disappeared from view, then blew out his breath, rubbing a hand viciously through his hair and muttering something in Gaelic. I didn't follow the finer points, but I gathered that he was comparing the character of our recent visitors to that of Mr. Higgins's piles, to the detriment of the former.
"Beg pardon, sir?"
Higgins looked bewildered but anxious to please. Jamie glanced at him.
"Let them awa' and bile their heads," he said, dismissing the Browns with a flip of the hand.
He caught my eye and turned toward the house.
"Come, Ben, Bobby. I've a thing or two to say to you."
I followed them in, both from curiosity and in case Mr. Higgins should feel faint again. He seemed steady enough, but still very pale. By contrast with Bobby Higgins, Mr. Weems, fair-haired and slight as his daughter, looked the picture of ruddy health. Whatever was the matter with Bobby, I wondered. I stole a discreet look at the seat of his breeches as I followed him, but that was all right. No bleeding. Jamie led the way into his study, gesturing at the motley collection of stools and boxes he used for visitors, but both Bobby and Mr. Weems chose to stand. Bobby, for obvious reasons. Mr. Weems, from respect. He was never comfortable sitting in Jamie's presence, save at meals.
Unhampered by either bodily or social reservations, I settled myself on the best stool and raised one eyebrow at Jamie, who had sat down himself at the table he used as a desk.
"This is the way of it," he said, without preamble. "Brown and his brother have declared themselves head of a committee of safety, and came to enlist me and my tenants as members of it."
He glanced at me, the corner of his mouth curling a little.
"I declined, as you doubtless noticed."
My stomach contracted slightly, thinking of what Major MacDonald had said, and of what I knew. It was beginning, then.
"Committee of safety?"
Mr. Weems looked bewildered and glanced at Bobby Higgins, who was beginning to look substantially less so.
"Have they so?" Bobby said softly.
Strands of curly brown hair had escaped from their binding. He fingered one back behind his ear.
"You've heard of such committees before, Mr. Higgins?" Jamie inquired, raising one brow.
"Met one, sir. Close-like."
Bobby touched a finger briefly below his blind eye. He was still pale, but beginning to recover his self-possession.
"Mobs, they be, sir. Like they mules, but more of them, and more wishes."
He gave a lopsided smile, smoothing the shirt sleeve over the bite on his arm. The mention of mules reminded me abruptly, and I stood up, putting a sudden stop to the conversation. "Lizzie? Where's Lizzie?" Not waiting for an answer to this rhetorical question, I went to the study door and shouted her name, only to be met by silence. She'd gone in for brandy, and there was plenty, in a jug in the kitchen, and she knew that. I'd seen her reach it down for Mrs. Bug only the night before. She must be in the house. Surely she wouldn't have gone.
"Elizabeth? Elizabeth, where are you?"
Mr. Weems was right behind me, calling as I strode down the hall to the kitchen. Lizzie was lying in a dead faint on the hearth, a limp bundle of clothes, one frail hand flung out as though she'd tried to save herself as she fell.
"Miss Weems!"
Bobby Higgins shouldered his way past me, looking frantic, and scooped her up into his arms.
"Elizabeth!"
Mr. Weems elbowed his way past me as well, his face nearly as white as his daughter's.
"Do let me look at her, will you?" I said, elbowing firmly back. "Put her down on the settle, Bobby, do."
He rose carefully with her in his arms, then sat down on the settle, still holding her, wincing slightly as he did so.
Well, if he wanted to be a hero, I hadn't time to argue with him.
I knelt and seized her wrist in search of a pulse, smoothing the pale hair off her face with my other hand. One look had been enough to tell me what was likely the matter. She was clammy to the touch, and the pallor of her face was tinged with grey. I could feel the tremor of oncoming chills that ran through her flesh, unconscious as she was.
"The ague's back, is it?" Jamie asked.
He'd appeared by my side, and was gripping Mr. Weems by the shoulder, at once comforting and restraining.
"Yes," I said briefly.
Lizzie had malaria, contracted on the coast a few years before, and was subject to occasional relapses, although she hadn't had one in more than a year. Mr. Weems took a deep, audible breath, a little colour coming back to his face. He was familiar with malaria, and had confidence that I could deal with it. I had, several times before. I hoped that I could this time. Lizzie's pulse was fast and light under my fingers, but regular, and she was beginning to stir. Still, the speed and suddenness with which the attack had come on was frightening. Had she had any warning? I hoped the concern I felt didn't show on my face. "Take her up to her bed, cover her, get a hot stone for her feet," I said, rising and addressing Bobby and Mr. Weems briskly in turn. "I'll start some medicine brewing." Jamie followed me down to the surgery, glancing back over his shoulder to be sure that the others were out of earshot before speaking.
"I thought you were out of the Jesuit bark," he asked, low-voiced.
"I am, damn it."
Malaria was a chronic disease, but for the most part, I'd been able to keep it under control with small, regular doses of cinchona bark. but I'd run out of Cinchona during the winter, and no one had yet been able to travel down to the coast for more.
So then?
I'm thinking. I pulled open the door of the cupboard and gazed at the neat ranks of glass bottles therein, many of them empty, or with no more than a few scattered crumbs of leaf or root inside. Everything was depleted after a cold, wet winter of grip, influenza, chilblains, and hunting accidents. Febrifuges. I had a number of things that would help a normal fever. Malaria was something else. There was plenty of dogwood root and bark, at least. I had collected immense quantities during the fall, foreseeing the need. I took that down, and after a moment's thought, added the jar containing a sort of gentian known locally as ague weed. "Put on the kettle, will you?" I asked Jamie, frowning to myself as I crumbled roots, bark, and weed into my mortar. All I could do was to treat the superficial symptoms of fever and chill. And shock, I thought. Better treat for that, too. "And bring me a little honey, too, please," I called after him, as he had already reached the door. He nodded and went hurriedly toward the kitchen, his footsteps quick and solid on the oak floorboards. I began to pound the mixture, still turning over additional possibilities. Some small part of my mind was half glad of the emergency. I could put off, for a little while, the necessity of hearing about the Browns and their beastly committee. I had a most uneasy feeling. Whatever they wanted, it didn't portend anything good, I was sure. They certainly hadn't left on friendly terms. As for what Jamie might feel obliged to do in response to them... Horse chestnut. That was sometimes used for the tertian ague, as Dr. Rawlings called it. Did I have any left? Glancing quickly over the jars and bottles in the medicine chest, I stopped, seeing one with an inch or so of dried black globules left at the bottom. "Gallberries," the label read. Not mine. It was one of Rawlings' jars. I'd never used them for anything, but something niggled at my memory. I'd heard or read something about gallberries. What was it? Half unconsciously, I picked up the jar and opened it, sniffing. A sharp, astringent smell rose from the berries, slightly bitter, and slightly familiar. Still holding the jar, I went to the table where my big black casebook lay, and flipped hastily to the early pages, those notes left by the man who had first owned both book and medicine chest, Daniel Rawlings. Where had it been? I was still flipping pages, scanning for the shape of a half-remembered note, when Jamie came back, a jug of hot water and a dish of honey in hand, and the Beardsley twins dogging his steps. I glanced at them, but said nothing. They tended to pop up unexpectedly, like a pair of jack-in-the-boxes. "Is Miss Lizzie fearfully sick?" Joe asked, anxiously peering round Jamie to see what I was doing. "Yes," I said briefly, only half-paying attention to him. "Don't worry, though. I'm fixing her some medicine." There it was. A brief notation, added as an obvious afterthought to the account of treatment of a patient whose symptoms seemed clearly malarial, and who had, I noticed with an unpleasant twinge, died.
"I am told by the trader from whom I procured Jesuit bark that the Indians use a plant called gallberry, which rivals the bark of cinchona for bitterness, and is thought capital for use in tertian and quartan fevers. I have collected some for experiment, and propose to try an infusion so soon as the opportunity presents itself."
I picked out one of the dried berries and bit into it. The pungent taste of quinine at once flooded my mouth, accompanied by a copious flood of saliva, as my mouth puckered at the eye-watering bitterness. Gallberry, indeed. I dived for the open window, spat into the herb bed beneath, and went on spitting, to the accompaniment of giggles and snorts from the Beardsleys, who were most diverted at the unexpected entertainment.
"Are you all right, Sassenach?"
Amusement was fighting with worry for dominance of Jamie's face. He poured a bit of water from the jug into a clay beaker, added a dollop of honey as an afterthought, and handed it to me.
Fine, I croaked. Don't drop that.
Kezzy Beardsley had picked up the jar of gallberries and was sniffing cautiously at it. He nodded at my admonition, but didn't put the jar down, instead handing it off to his brother. I took a good mouthful of hot honeyed water and swallowed.
Those?
They have something like quinine in them. Jamie's face changed at once, the worry lessening.
So they'll help the lass.
I hope so. There aren't many, though.
Do you mean you need more of these things for Miss Lizzie, Mrs. Fraser?
Joe glanced up at me, dark eyes sharp over the little jar.
Yes, I said, surprised. You don't mean you know where to get any, surely? Aye, ma'am, Kezzy said, his voice a little loud as usual. Indians got them.
Which Indians?
Jamie asked, his gaze sharpening.
Them Cherokee, Joe said, waving vaguely over one shoulder. By the mountain.
This description might have suited half a dozen villages, but evidently it was a specific village that they had in mind, for the two of them turned as one, obviously intending to go directly and fetch back gallberries.
Wait a bit, lads, Jamie said, snagging Kezzy by the collar. I'll go along with you. You'll be needing something to trade, after all.
Oh, we got hides aplenty, sir, Joe assured him. 'Twas a good season.
Joe was an expert hunter, and while Kezzy still hadn't sufficiently keen hearing to hunt well, his brother had taught him to run trap lines. Ian had told me that the Beardsley's shack was stacked nearly to the roof tree with the hides of beaver, marten, deer, and ermine. The smell of it always clung to them, a faint miasma of dried blood, musk, and cold hair.
Aye. Well, that's generous of you, Joe, to be sure. But I'll come nonetheless.
Jamie glanced at me, acknowledging the fact that he had made his decision, but asking for my approval nonetheless. I swallowed, tasting bitterness.
Yes, I said,
and cleared my throat. If you're going, let me send some things and tell you what to ask for in trade. You won't leave until morning, surely. The Beardsleys were vibrating with impatience to be gone, but Jamie stood still looking at me, and I felt him touch me without words or movement.
No,
he said softly.
We'll bide for the night.
He turned then to the Beardsleys.
Go up, will you, Joe, and ask Bobby Higgins to come down. I'll need to speak with him.
He's up with Miss Lizzie.
Joe Beardsley looked displeased at this, and his brother's face echoed his expression of slit-eyed suspicion.
What's he a-doing in her room, then? Don't he know she's betrothed?
Kezzy asked righteously.
Her father's with her, too, Jamie assured them. Her reputation's safe, aye?
Joe snorted briefly, but the brothers exchanged glances, then left together, slender shoulders set in determination to oust this threat to Lizzie's virtue.
So you'll do it. I set down the pestle. Be an Indian agent.
I think I must. If I do not, Richard Brown surely will. I think I cannot risk that.
He hesitated, then drew close and touched me lightly, fingers on my elbow.
I'll send the lads back at once with the berries you need. I may need to stay for a day, maybe two, for the talking, aye?
To tell the Cherokee that he was now an agent for the British Crown, he meant, and to make arrangements for word to be spread that the headman of the mountain villages should come down later to a council for parley and gifts. I nodded, feeling a small bubble of fear swell under my breastbone. It was starting. No matter how much one knows that something dreadful is going to happen in the future, one somehow never thinks it will be today. Not... Don't stay away too long, will you? I blurted, not wanting to burden him with my fears, but unable to keep quiet.
No,
he said softly, and his hand rested for an instant in the small of my back.
Then afash yourself. I'll not tarry.
The sound of feet descending the stairs echoed in the hall. I supposed Mr. Weems had shooed the Beardsleys out along with Bobby. They didn't stop, but went off without speaking, casting looks of veiled dislike at Bobby, who seemed quite oblivious to them.
"Yon lad said you wanted to speak to me, sir."
He'd regained some colour, I was glad to see, and seemed steady enough on his feet. He glanced uneasily at the table, still spread with the sheet I'd put him on, and then at me. But I merely shook my head. I'd finish dealing with his piles later.
"Aye, Bobby."
Jamie made a brief gesture toward a stool, as though to invite Bobby to sit. But I cleared my throat in a meaningful manner, and he stopped, then leaned against the table, rather than sitting down himself.
"Those two who came, Brown, they're called. They've a settlement some way away. You said you've heard of the committees of safety, eh? So you'll have some notion what they're about."
"Aye, sir."
"The Browns, sir. Did they want me?"
He spoke calmly enough, but I saw him swallow briefly, Adam's apple bobbing in his slender throat. Jamie sighed and ran a hand through his hair. The sun was slanting through the window now, and struck him directly, making his red hair glow with flame, and picking out here and there a flicker of the silver that was beginning to show among the ruddy strands.
"They did. They kent you were here, heard of you, doubtless, from someone you met along the way. You'll have told folk where you were headed, I suppose."
Bobby nodded, wordless. "What did they want with him?" I asked, tipping the ground root bark and berries into a bowl and pouring hot water over them to steep.
"They didn't make that quite clear," Jamie said dryly. "But then I didn't give them the chance. I only told them that they'd take a guest from my hearth over my dead body. And theirs."
"I thanks ye for that, sir."
Bobby took a deep breath.
"They knew, I reckon, about Boston. I'd not told anyone that, surely."
Jamie's frown deepened slightly.
"Aye, they did. They pretended to think I didn't ken. Told me I was harbouring a murderer unbeknownst, and a threat to the public welfare."
"Well, the first is true enough," Bobby said, touching his brand gingerly as though it still burned him.
He offered a wan smile.
"But I dunno as I should be a threat to anyone these days."
Jamie dismissed that.
"The point is, Bobby, that they do ken you're here. They'll not come and drag you away, I think. But I'd ask you to go canny about the place. I'll make provision to see you safely back to Lord John when the time comes, with an escort. I gather you're no quite finished with him?" he asked, turning to me.
"Not quite," I replied equably.
Bobby looked apprehensive.
"Well, then."
Jamie reached into the waist of his breeches and drew out a pistol which had been hidden by the folds of his shirt. It was, I saw, the fancy gilt-edged one.
"Keep it by you," Jamie said, handing it to Bobby. "There's powder and shot in the sideboard. Will you look out for my wife and family, then, whilst I'm gone?"
"Oh!"
Bobby looked startled, but then nodded, tucking the pistol away in his own breeches.
"I will so, sir. Depend upon it."
Jamie smiled at him, his eyes warming.
"That's a comfort to me, Bobby. Will you maybe go and find my son-in-law? I'll need a word with him before I go."
"Aye, sir. Right away."
He squared his shoulders and set off, an expression of determination on his poet's face. "What do you think they would have done with him?" I asked softly as the outer door closed behind him. "The Browns." Jamie shook his head.
"God knows. Hanged him at a crossroad, maybe. Or maybe only beaten him and driven him out of the mountain. They want to make a show of being able to protect the foci from dangerous criminals and the like," he added, with a twist of the mouth.
"A government derives its powers from the just consent of the governed," I quoted, nodding.
"For a committee of safety to have any legitimacy, there needs to be an obvious threat to the public safety. Clever of the Browns to have reasoned that out."
He gave me a look, one auburn brow raised.
Who said that?
The consent of the governed.
Thomas Jefferson, I replied, feeling smug. Or rather, he will say it in another 2 years.
He'll steal it from a gentleman named Locke in another 2 years, he corrected. I suppose Richard Brown must have been decently educated.
Unlike me, you mean? I said, unruffled. If you expect trouble from the Browns, though, should you have given Bobby that particular pistol? He shrugged.
I'll need the good ones, and I doubt very much that he'll fire that one.
Counting on its deterrent effect? I was sceptical, but he was likely right.
Aye, that, but more on Bobby.
How so?
I doubt he'd fire a gun again to save his own life, but he would, maybe, to save yours. And should it come to such a pass, they'll be too close to miss.
He spoke with dispassion, but I felt the hairs prickle down my nape. Well, that's a comfort, I said. And just how do you know what he'd do?
Talk to him, he said briefly. The man he shot in Boston was the first he'd ever killed. He doesn't want to do it again.
He straightened and moved restlessly toward the counter, where he busied himself in straightening a scatter of small instruments I had laid out for cleaning. I moved to stand beside him, watching. There was a handful of small cautery irons and scalpels soaking in a beaker of turpentine. He took them out one by one, wiped them dry, and laid them back in their box neatly, side by side. The spade-shaped metal ends of the irons were blackened by use. The scalpel blades were weathered to a soft glow, but the sharp edges gleamed, a hair-breadth of bright silver. "We'll be all right," I said quietly. I meant it to be a reassuring statement, but it came out with a tinge of question.
I know, he said.
He put the last iron in its box, but didn't replace the lid. Instead, he stood, hands spread flat on the counter, looking straight ahead.
I dinna want to go, he said softly. I dinna want to do this.
I wasn't sure whether he was speaking to me or to himself, but I thought he wasn't referring only to his journey to the Cherokee village.
Neither do I whispered, and moved a little closer, so I felt his breathing.
He lifted his hands then, and turned toward me, taking me into his arms, and we stood wrapped close, listening to each other's breathing, the bitter smell of the brewing tea seeping through the homely scents of linen, dust, and sun-warmed flesh. There were still choices to be made, decisions to reach, actions to take. Many of them. But in one day, 1 hour, one single declaration of intent, we had stepped across the threshold of war. Chapter 10. Duty Calls. Jamie had sent Bobby after Roger Mack, but found himself too restless to wait, and set off himself, leaving Claire to her brewing. Everything seemed peaceful and beautiful outside. A brown sheep with a pair of lambs stood indolently in her pen, jaws moving in a slow stupor of satisfaction, the lambs hopping awkwardly to and fro like fuzzy grasshoppers behind her. Claire's herb bed was full of leafing greens and sprouting flowers. The well lid was ajar. He bent to draw it into place and found the boards had warped. He added fixing that to the constant list of chores and repairs that he carried in his head, wishing fervently that he could devote the next few days to digging, hauling manure, shingling and the like, instead of what he was about to do. He'd rather bury the old privy pit or castrate pigs than go and ask Roger Mack what he kent about Indians and revolutions. He found it mildly gruesome to discuss the future with his son-in-law, and tried never to do it. The things Claire told him of her own time seemed often fantastic, with the enjoyable, half-real sense of fairy tales, and sometimes macabre, but always interesting, for what he learned of his wife from the telling. Brianna tended to share with him small, homely details of machinery, which were interesting,
or wild stories of men walking on the moon, which were immensely entertaining, but no threat to his peace of mind. Roger Mack, though, had a cold-blooded way of talking that reminded him to an uncomfortable degree of the works of the historians he'd read, and had, therefore, a sense of concrete doom about it. Talking to Roger Mack made it seem all too likely that this, that, or the other frightful happenstance was not only indeed going to happen, but would most likely have direct and personal consequences. It was like talking to a particularly evil-minded fortune-teller, he thought, when you hadn't paid enough to hear something pleasant. The thought made a sudden memory pop up on the surface of his mind, bobbing like a fishing cork. In Paris, he'd been with friends, other students, drinking in the piss-smelling taverns near the Université. He'd been fairly drunk himself when someone took a fancy to have his palms read, and he had pushed with the others into the corner where the old woman, who did it, always sat, scarcely visible amid the gloom and clouds of pipe smoke. He hadn't intended to do it himself. He had only a few pennies in his pocket, and didn't mean to waste them on unholy nonsense. He'd said so, loudly. Whereupon a scraggy claw had shot out of the darkness and seized his hand, sinking long, filthy nails into his flesh. He'd yelped in surprise, and his friends all laughed. They laughed harder when she spat in his palm. She rubbed the spittle into his skin in a businesslike way, bent close enough that he could smell the ancient sweat of her and see the lice crawling in the grizzled hair that kicked from the edge of her rusty black shawl. She peered into his hand, and a dirty nail traced the lines of it, tickling. He tried to pull his hand away, but she tightened her grip on his wrist, and he found to his surprise that he couldn't break it.
Tu es un chat, tu?
The old woman had remarked in tones of malicious interest.
You are a cat, you. A little red cat.
Dubois, that was his name, Dubois, had at once begun to meow and yowl to the amusement of the others. He himself refused to rise to the bait, and saying only, "Merci, madame," tried again to pull away.
"Neuf," she said, tapping rapid, random places on his palm. Then, seizing a finger and wiggling it by way of emphasis, "You have a 9 in your hand."
"And death," she'd added offhandedly.
"You'll die 9 times before you rest in your grave."
She'd let go then amidst a chorus of sarcastic,
"Oh, la la,"
from the French students, and laughter from the rest. He snorted, sending the memory back where it came from, and good riddance to it. The old woman refused to go so easily, though, and called to him through the years as she'd called through the raucous, beer-filled air of the tavern.
"Sometimes dying doesn't hurt, mon petit chat," she'd called after him, mocking. "But more often it does."
"No, it doesn't," he muttered, and stopped, appalled, hearing himself. Christ, it wasn't himself he was hearing, but his godfather.
"Don't be afraid, laddie. It doesn't hurt a bit to die."
He missed his footing and staggered, caught himself and stood still, a taste of metal on the back of his tongue. His heart was thumping suddenly for no reason, as though he had run miles. He saw the cabin, certainly, and heard the calling of jays in the half-leafed chestnut trees. But he saw even more clearly Myrtle's face, the grim lines of it relaxing into peace, and the deep-set black eyes fixed on his, shifting in and out of focus, as though his godfather looked at once at him and at something far beyond him. He felt the weight of Myrtle's body in his arms, growing suddenly heavy as he died. The vision vanished as abruptly as it had come, and he found himself standing next to a rain puddle, staring at a wooden duck half-mired in the mud. He crossed himself, with a quick word for the repose of Myrtle's soul, then bent and retrieved the duck, washing the mud away in the puddle. His hands were trembling, and little wonder.
His memories of Culloden were few and fragmentary, but they were beginning to come back.
So far, such things had come to him only in glimpses at the edge of sleep.
He'd seen Murtaugh there before, and in the dreams that followed.
He hadn't told Claire about them.
Not yet.
He pushed open the door of the cabin, but it was empty, the hearth smoured, spinning wheel and loom standing idle.
Brianna was likely at Fergus's place, visiting Marsali. Where would Roger Mack be now?
He stepped back outside and stood listening. The thump of an axe came faintly from somewhere in the forest beyond the cabin. It stopped then, and he heard men's voices raised in greeting. He turned and headed for the trail that led upslope, half grown over with spring grass, but showing the black smudges of fresh footmarks.
What might the old woman have told him if he'd paid her? He wondered.
Had she lied to spite him for his miserliness?
Or told him the truth, for the same reason?